Hey, this is Dave Maupin. I'm here with Jim Paisley and Bill Mulder. This is the Show Me History Show, Missouri perspective on history. Right now we're doing Civil War history, but we've done a lot of different history. We're going to be talking about the Missouri Confederate Brigade, or the Confederate Missouri Brigade, and their contribution. We already did one show 2 weeks ago, and now we're going to be talking about the battles of Corinth and Vicksburg and their contribution to those battles.
And we could actually split this into two and just make Vicksburg a whole show into itself.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's so layered.
Yeah, we might not even see how far we get.
where we left off with that group, you know, for our listeners, you'll remember that this was just a bunch of Missouri boys, and they wound up following Price all the way down into Arkansas and Battle of Pea Ridge, and then, you know, they, junkered back into Missouri for a bit and then found themselves driven back out. And so they had the option of joining with the Confederacy as, you know, regular Confederate troops, because before that they were just the State Guard. But a lot of people kind of forget about all those Missouri boys that were fighting for the Confederacy. And like you said, you know, as we were discussing it, we thought, boy, we ought to do a show on all the other things that they did, you know, especially Corinth and Vicksburg. I mean, they were very active, one of the best units that the Confederacy had.
Oh, yeah, well-known and well-respected.
Absolutely, absolutely. So,
yeah, and just to remind folks, we're coming from Dam Radio. If you need to call in or you have any questions while we're talking, feel free to call in. You can reach us at 573-746-8020. It's 573-746-8020, so it's damradio.com. Of course, if you knew that, you probably already know the web address, otherwise you wouldn't be hearing
any
of this.
So. Right.
But we also record these episodes, so you can, maybe a week or two afterwards, you can listen to it if you couldn't make it for this particular show, so you can always listen to them later.
And if you're a homeschool parent, might be something, a good resource for you.
Yeah, and again, being a librarian, you know, I'm going to plug a good book for you on this. Those of you that are interested in this Battle at Vicksburg, a friend of mine, his name's Sandy Mitchum, goes under Samuel Mitchum. Guy's written like 40 books. He's a professor from LSU. He wrote a book titled Vicksburg, and it's just probably one of the best that you can find. It's got tons and tons of diary entries from the people that were there in Vicksburg, a lot of primary sources dealing with the generals involved, Grant and Pemberton and all of them. And it's a great book. And like I say, it's called Vicksburg, and it's by Samuel W. Mitchum, M-I-T-C-H-H-A-M.
Okay. Yeah, and there's a lot of books on the Civil War. One of the things I always tell people to look at is when you're going to read a Civil War book, before you decide to buy it or anything like that, you probably want to look at the bibliography. And if all you see back there is a bunch of links to the OR and battles and leaders of the Civil War, that's not really...
Right.
I mean, the OR is a pretty standard source, and the more books you read, the more quotes you start to recognize about the Civil War. That's because most of them are from the OR. I mean, Battles and Leaders of the Civil War is basically all of them arguing with each other after the war about who was at fault and who did what, who screwed up what.
Right.
But yeah, that's one of your best things to look at in a Civil War book. See what some of those bibliography sources are.
Yeah.
And am I coming through this, or am I coming through somebody else's?
Sound like you're coming in hollow. You may not be. You might want to switch to the other mic. Yeah.
That might be the bad one from last time.
Right.
It is. Hello.
There you are.
Hey.
Hey, JR, it's the it's the number three mic.
Yeah, number three. Yeah, you know.
Really. And if you ever get a chance to go down into Mississippi, do go to the Vicksburg Battlefield Memorial and the park itself. It's fascinating. You cannot imagine. I mean, it's good to read and look at maps, but until you set feet there and you see the landscape and understand then this is what they fought, this is what they were looking at, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to you, because that one, the city itself is actually the battlefield.
Yeah.
Like, in a lot of cases with these battlefields, the city messes up the battlefield because it grows and grows into where the battlefield was, and, you know, suburbs start to encroach. But that place, you just look up at the city, and that's pretty much...
Well, and you make such a good point there in that most of the battles take place, you know, in wilderness or out in big open fields, and you know, these troops lining up on either side and firing away in the volleys. this is urban warfare. It really is. It's one of the few instances that you see in the Civil War where you've got an entire city, a huge city by those standards, about 2,000 people, who are surrounded by 70,000 Union troops, and they just blast the living daylights out of these poor folks. And so, again, the logistics involved in warfare, we'll talk about Corinth first. And in Corinth, you know, you're talking a major rail hub. You know, so it's all about supplies, folks. An army can't go anywhere if it doesn't have the supplies. And
that's rivers and rails.
Rivers and rails, exactly. And so what we're going to talk about tonight is rails and rivers, you know, and that's exactly right. If you can gain control of those key points, you've got it. And same thing was happening in Missouri. The Union forces had taken over the Missouri River, which literally split our state in half. It also made for interesting transport of supplies from St. Louis to Kansas City by water, because these guys would sit up on the hills and take shots at the steamboats as they went by. Right. But, yeah, it's all about logistics at this point, because the North has driven into the South. They're taking the war to the South, but it doesn't make a bit of difference how many troops you have if you don't have food and clean water and munitions, you know, in order to keep that army afoot. And that's key here. That's what most of these battles are going
to
be.
Yeah, Corinth is the key railroad junction between Memphis all the way to Charleston. So we talked about it, but I actually looked it up afterwards. And yeah, Charleston is where it goes, I think, all the way to Chattanooga, and then it ends up in Charleston, that east-west rail line. So that lets them transfer supplies and troops to the east and west. It's important strategically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so when we last left off, the Missourians had crossed the Mississippi into the what's considered the Western Theater, but they'd really left Missouri and Arkansas. They'd left their mm-hmm. homes behind. They'd left their families basically to the perils of Union occupation. You know, mm-hmm. like a lot of these Confederate troops are protecting their own country, their own states, their own homelands. The Missourians had basically had to abandon their families to come fight for the Confederacy. And there was always that promise under Price that you guys will eventually be able to go back to Missouri and fight there, but just not right now. Right now, we need you guys here. The Missouri State Guard troops had almost all been converted into Confederate troops. They'd taken a Confederate oath at this point. The few that didn't want to do that, they went back to Arkansas, and they eventually became like the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th Missouri Infantry, fought at Prairie Grove and some mm-hmm. other fights there, Helena. But we're not going to talk about them now. We're going to stick with the nucleus of these Missouri units that ended mm-hmm. up becoming what we call the Missouri Brigade now. So yeah. When we last left Price, he had escaped from Iuka. Grant had planned a devious trap for him, but hadn't been able to spring the trap. So only one, Grant had basically divided his forces, sent Rosecrans around from the south while he was going to come up to the north and attack. And Grant never heard the attack start because of what we call an acoustic shadow. So he waited all day for when is Rosecrans going to attack? He didn't realize Rosecrans was getting beaten up by Price the whole time. Yeah. Price wanted to fight again the next day. His guys all told him, are you crazy? Because I'm pretty sure Grant and Ord are just north of us, mm-hmm. and they've got even more troops. So Price decided he was going to squirt out the side. He retreated and tricked Rosecrans and got out away from him. And then there's a lot of recriminations on the Union side. Grant's mad at Rosecrans. Rosecrans, there's allegations. What's the excuse always with Grant when something goes wrong, right? They go to the papers and they say, oh, I hear glug, glug, glug. Mm-hmm. Grant, and mm-hmm. maybe one of the reasons he didn't fight was Grant had been drinking.
Drinking and smoking a cigar.
So this does not endear Rosecrans to Grant, because he knows right away, I know what's going on. Like, right. I know who's planting these stories about me. So there was always this kind of animosity a little bit between Rosecrans and Grant. But so Price gets out. At this point, his division is basically, Hebert is commanding what was Price's division. He's teamed up with Van Dorn. There was a lot of confusion over who he's supposed to help. Bragg asked for Price's Missouri troops. Jeff Davis at the last minute said, no, you can go help Van Dorn. No one actually tells Bragg that that's what's happening. So mm-hmm. Bragg is kind of waiting for Price's troops eventually. Doesn't realize that Price is going to team up with Van Dorn. Mm-hmm. And at this point, what we would call Hebert's division, was the first brigade that had the 2nd Missouri under Cockrell, who'll become well-known. We'll know mm-hmm. him soon. Mm-hmm. He's going to come out. Some of these guys die. Some of these guys become more important. We've also, just to recap, lost Major General Little, who was one of the formative generals, shot in the forehead at Iuka. Mm-hmm. Very traumatic for Price. This guy was a highly respected Missouri State Guard commander. He's dead. Mm-hmm. So that's why Hebert takes over kind of for him. Mm-hmm. So we got the 2nd Missouri, the 3rd Missouri, the 5th Missouri, 1st Missouri Dismounted Cavalry under Lieutenant Colonel W.D. Maupin. There we go. Maupin makes their way on the scene.
There you go.
And Wade's battery and the 16th Arkansas. I guess we have to mention there was one Arkansas. Yeah.
Well, the 5th Missouri Infantry CSA, there was a fellow named David Mulder.
Yeah.
And went all the way down there. At Vicksburg, he was facing some of his cousins and other family members that were part of the Federal mm-hmm. Brigade.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's another thing we need to interject here is, up until now, when we've been talking about the Missouri troops, we're talking small, relatively small groups, you know, under 10,000. Now, when they cross to the east of the Mississippi, now all of a sudden you're in the full-scale theater, and you're talking, this is where you're getting these, hearing about these casualty rates of, you know, getting in a battle with 70,000 guys on either side.
Right, and this is Price's division. This was the whole army that fought in Missouri.
That's
so
right.
They come to the other side of the Mississippi, and they're lucky if they can be big enough to be one division in this Confederate army.
Well, isn't it fascinating? So you had somebody involved, and Bill, you had somebody. I had a relative that was Major General Henry Talbot Walker. He was killed at Corinth. So all three of us had somebody involved in this. Now, those of you that are doing your genealogy, this is something you need to think about. You know, a lot of people look up and say, okay, I'm looking, and they fought for the Missouri Brigade, and they'll find out that they died in Louisiana or in Mississippi.
Right.
And the reason why, folks, is, you know, tracking what we're doing here, you can see that the Missouri boys are now fully involved in the Civil War, and they went where the war was.
Yeah.
And, you know, Missouri's occupied at the time by the Union forces, and, you know, guerrillas are doing their thing. But most of the people from Missouri, if you trace your roots back, you're going to find out that your relatives who fought in the Civil War on both sides are going to wind up, the ones that become casualties are killed not in the state of Missouri.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
Well, and, you know, in today's technology world where we can touch somebody easily, mm-hmm. hey, I'm over here on this side. What are you doing over here shooting at me? David and his, that would have been his first cousin, did not know, they were both there at Vicksburg, did not know that they were both there at the same time until they were both back in Camden County after the war.
Wow.
And they got to talking about it. Well, man, it was tough. You know, I was imprisoned after Vicksburg, and
Spoilers. Don't, mm-hmm. Okay, now you guys know they got imprisoned after Vicksburg.
But wasn't a situation in some of these battles, I think at Corinth, where we had, you're the one that brought it up, there were federal troops on one side and Confederate troops on the other, but both came from Missouri.
Yeah.
And they wound up opposite each other, straight across the battlefield.
It happens
from one
in both battles,
So you're shooting Missourians on both sides. Well, bizarre.
And the Mulder family come into the United States through South Carolina.
Mm.
Okay. So we had relatives there, and Virginia, and North Carolina, and Tennessee, and Texas.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean, it was a lot of Southern sympathy there.
Sure.
But then you had another branch that went north of the river, and they're all German now.
Right.
And they become
Union. Yeah. Yeah.
The Dutch.
Yeah. But, you know, that's another great point in that, you know, Missouri being the jumping off point for the West had a diverse population.
Yeah, and many of these people we talked about were born somewhere else.
Yeah,
right.
Even if they were not German, they were born in, when we talk about it, they're born in Savannah or Philadelphia.
Right.
Or they all make their way out.
A lot of our relatives migrated from Kentucky and Tennessee into Missouri when Missouri was first formed. but they're moving into a state that's also populated heavily with people from Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Dutch. You had all kinds of different nationalities here because, again, we were the West.
Yeah. And then we had the Michigan part of the family, which would be the paternal grandparent, who was a Wyandotte Indian.
There you go.
And went to Oklahoma. So guess what? Guess what their sympathies were?
Yeah. Yeah.
They were very much CSA.
Yeah.
It's just so fun to read this because my paternal grandfather, his relatives in that time were Union people.
See? Yeah. And it, there again, you know, it truly was a civil war. I can't emphasize that enough, folks.
I mean, it is named the Civil War.
Yeah. But, you know, everybody wants to just say, you know, well, Union versus Confederate. But this literally was brother against brother. You know, there was a famous quote about Lincoln when he married Mary Todd, his wife. She had four brothers, and they interviewed one of the brothers, and he was fighting for the South, and they asked him about Lincoln, and he said he's the greatest scoundrel left unhung.
That's funny.
So, you know, Thanksgiving had to be fun at that house.
Well, the star of this story is going to be one of Bill's favorite generals, Earl Van Dorn. Oh. I know Bill's a big fan of this guy.
Yeah, huge fan.
So there's a bunch. There's actually two Confederate brigades that are Missourian here. They're kind of they're pretty strong at this point. They've just come over. They've been recruiting from across the river also, so they're kind of beefed up. They're in camp. They've been training a lot. Van Dorn has Price with him now, and he decides, I'm going to attack Corinth because that's how I'm going to help Bragg out. I'm going to march north and attack Corinth. So Van Dorn does this funny thing where he's, you know, how kids today like to say, like, I'm going to manifest something. Like, if I want something good to happen, I'm just going to say it and it's going to happen. Well, Van Dorn does this thing where he goes, I'm going to rename our army. And everyone's like, oh, geez. Like, you know, he comes out and he goes, guys, I had a great dream last night. And this is going to really help us win. We are going to rename the army. And they're like, okay, Earl, what's it going to be? He goes, we are going to be called the Army of West Tennessee because we are marching. Not to spoil it for anyone, but we're marching to West Tennessee. And if we make ourselves the Army of West Tennessee, I feel like we're going to be able to conquer it. Like, that's going to somehow make it all happen for them. So he declares that. He renames his army. So now they're the Army of West Tennessee. Van Dorn knows that Rosecrans is up there. He's got about 15,000 troops. Van Dorn, with Price, has about 22,000. So he's like, okay, Those are decent odds. I mean, usually the Confederates are outnumbered, so they're thinking we might be able to do okay with those numbers. But we all know the tactical training these guys get at West Point, right? You need an advantage of like 3-1, probably, right? So here maybe he's hoping, okay, it's close enough to where we might get lucky. First of all, Corinth is fortified. Because if we remember, the Confederates were defending Corinth before, and at the time, Beauregard actually built breastworks, dug rifle pits, built artillery positions. So Price is remembering all this, and he's like, isn't that the town that was like fortified by us, and then we left it? Like, remember, there's fortifications there. Price also is saying, there's also 8,000 troops that are about to be paroled from Fort Donelson. And we had talked about this before. In these days, they didn't even have jails, really, that they wanted to support prisoners. There were not prisoner of war camps until 1864, like mid to late 1864. When you got captured, they would instead make you swear an oath and promise that you would not fight again unless you were exchanged for other prisoners. So if the Confederates captured 8,000 Union troops, and then you captured 8,000 Confederate troops, they would basically swap them on paper, and then those guys were free. How they kept track of who was allowed to, who knows? But it was kind of an honor system to go through with it. So Price is saying, I get what you're saying, buddy. You really want to go attack, but we have a chance to get 8,000 more guys. If we can just wait for these guys and equip them, they can join us, and then we'll have 30,000. Mm-hmm. Nope. Van Dorn doesn't want to wait. He's not a waiter. He's not a guy that's going to take his time and not go up there. So he says, we're going after it. Rosecrans, here's that Van Dorn's moving on him. And one of my favorite things to talk about is both of these guys were in the same West Point class, Earl Van Dorn and Rosecrans.
So they know each other.
What do you think Rosecrans was in his West Point class out of 56?
He
was fifth.
Really?
He was fifth. Rosecrans.
Wow.
Rosecrans actually sometimes gets things right. Rosecrans' problem in fighting is always that when the some people are cool and collected, like Stonewall Jackson, when everything's going crazy. Rosecrans freaks out during the middle of a battle. He'll have a great plan, but the second things start going sideways, he gets excited, sends out strange orders, and so that's really his downfall, is his nerves. So he was fifth. Out of 56, what do we think Van Dorn was?
Oh, he had to be at the tail end.
Right.
52nd in his class.
There you go.
So here you have the same class. The guy from it was fifth in his class is defending. The guy that was 52nd is attacking. So Rosecrans looks at the situation and says, man, Van Dorn is going to try some really sneaky attack on me. What I would do, I would maneuver, cut off my line of supplies, force me out of this fortified position where then I have to do battle to him. That's what Rosecrans is expecting Van Dorn to do. Van Dorn says, no, we're just going to march around behind him, just like he did at Pea Ridge, and just attack from the opposite side, full on, full frontal attack. In fact, he's attacking in the direction that the Confederate defenses had been facing when they were originally built. They were facing north. Mm-hmm. Now, after it was occupied, they also built defenses to the south. Now, there's some stories that there was a spy that was captured by Rosecrans, and she was trying to get out, and she was going to tell Van Dorn, attack from the north because the defenses aren't as strong. And once they captured this spy, Rosecrans then built more breastworks and really strengthened the northern part. I've heard that story, but when you actually read a lot of stuff that Rosecrans writes, especially in like Battles and Leaders, he doesn't really mention the spy at all very much. I haven't seen a lot where he talks about the spy, and there's almost no history on her, but so who knows. But so Van Dorn commits to, we're going to attack from the north part, so we're going to march up from the south, we're going to do a big loop around, cut through Tennessee, and then come in and attack Corinth from the north, and that's how we're going to do it. And Rosecrans is, of course, so smart that he's thinking only an idiot would try an attack like that. Like, there's no way that's actually Van Dorn's plan. Mm-hmm. So I still have to be wary. I don't know what he's got up his sleeve. What Van Dorn doesn't realize is as he's marching out, obviously he's not sneaking up on Rosecrans. Cavalry's reporting on the movement of the Confederates. They're getting information. Rosecrans starts calling in all these other garrisons from Iuka, other areas, because Van Dorn's doing this big loop. He's freeing up all these garrisons, Union garrisons, that don't have to sit down and watch him anymore. So by the time Van Dorn gets to where he's about to attack Corinth, Rosecrans's numbers have actually increased to around 23,000 troops. Mm. And some of them are still coming in on the night of the battle, but that slight margin that he had, 22,000 to 15,000, is gone. Yeah. So now he's basically attacking a force that's slightly larger than his force. God. So,
again, you know, I have to ask a question. It seems like almost every time we see this, and I've heard these stories about Grant. Grant was not very high up in his class, and I think I can't remember who it was that was talking about Grant, and I might have been Lee. And he said, you know, when they heard that Grant had been appointed head of the Union military, he said, we just lost the war. And he said, why? And he said, because he never read the books. And it almost makes you wonder here, where you've got one guy that finishes fifth in his class and the other guy finishes at the bottom, if it isn't the guy that didn't read the books. I mean, the ones that read the books knew what the tactic was. The other ones are like, no, we'll just go in there and blast the daylights.
Hood and Sheridan both did bad at West Point, but they were pretty good division commanders. At least Sheridan was better even as a guy.
They're shooting at you. Hood
did promote to his level of incompetence at some point. But.
Well, I mean, you nailed it. It's they didn't read the books, so they weren't locked into a linear way of thinking. Mm-hmm. They could look out and go, well, that's what he would do because he was high in the classes.
Yeah.
He knew he's going to follow that.
But there is the Van Dorn factor. I mean, and just to refresh you folks, we talk about this every time, but Van Dorn died during the war, but not in combat.
Well,
killed by a jealous husband.
Well, I mean, that could be a form of combat. Right.
I mean, there was a female spy that was coming to give him information about Corinth.
You know, there's a story there probably. Yeah,
that's right.
I always wondered, did Van Dorn smoke weed? when he was along the rivers, did he get a bunch of him?
Yeah, he was definitely a partier. I definitely get the feeling he was a bit of a partier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know.
That's why I think he was more suited to be a cavalryman. You know, you can kind of get a lot of loot.
Yeah.
You're getting boots full of whiskey and stuff like that. And
there you go. You know, but it is.
It's like the J-Rock champion type leader.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, J-Rock probably would have never risen to brigade command.
No.
Yes, so at this point, Van Dorn's in three divisions. His army comes crashing in from the north. The problem is, like we've always talked about Van Dorn, he does not know how to pace his troops. He drives his troops too far trying to get to a position so that by the time they get at Pea Ridge, it was the same thing. The guys were marched through the cold. They were exhausted by the time they marched all night to get to Pea Ridge. They were practically exhausted. You almost lost half the battle by the time you get into combat. Same thing in this battle. He marches them and marches them and marches them until by the time they're in position, the troops have been, they're doing like 20 miles a day. And so they're worn out.
Well, and I guess, you know, something that Bill and I were talking about before we started this evening is the terrain on these battlefields.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to look at it in a book where it's a flat page and it's showing move your troops over here. But when you start actually trying to move 10,000 troops over hill country and through brush and across marshes, now all of a sudden that's a whole different game too, as far as logistics go.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this battle too is this is the first battle where all these Missouri regiments fight together. So before, the 1st Missouri had fought alone at Shiloh. Now it's at Corinth. It's not with the Missouri Brigade though. The 1st Missouri is actually in Bowen's brigade over by Lavelle. So there's basically three divisions in Van Dorn's army. Lovell's on the right as they attack from the north. I think Dabney Morey's in the center, and Hebert is on their left wing. Rosecrans is right as they're crashing down from the north. Lovell's somebody who we're going to hear about later, too. He was the in charge at New Orleans, defending New Orleans. Okay. And we all know about the year-long siege of New Orleans that was fought. You know, that's successful. No, it wasn't. They captured it in about 2 hours, folks. Basically, Lovell, they just sailed right in, right past his forts, and then started shelling the city, and he had to surrender. In fact, he had to demand a court-martial because he was accused of negligence. but so he comes to this battle with his reputation as the guy who basically lost New Orleans.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was up against a really good leader, David Farragut.
Yeah, and this is a Jeff Davis situation, to be honest. One of the reasons why he was actually exonerated by his court martial or court of inquiry, because Jeff Davis was pulling all these troops away from him in New Orleans, and Jeff Davis will never admit that he did something wrong. So the second New Orleans falls, he's just, the laser eye is looking for who to blame for this disaster.
Well, and again, this ties into what we were talking about earlier, rivers and railroads. Mm-hmm. And so if you can capture New Orleans, and you've got control of the Mississippi down as far as St. Louis, now all of a sudden, you know, you've only got a little stretch left, and you've got a straight superhighway all the way through to where now, you know, supplies are coming into New Orleans for the Union troops that can be distributed.
Sure.
You've got supplies coming in from the north that can be distributed. And so, again, looking at it from a tactical point, these are key places to capture.
Yeah, and the important thing to note, remember, too, is this was a time of ironclads and steamboats.
Right.
So ironclads could make a run on the Mississippi past a fortress, but the transports could not. They weren't armored. They just weren't powerful enough to be armored and carry all that cargo. Mm-hmm. So that was the real problem. You could sail past a fort. You just couldn't transport anything. You couldn't move troops. You couldn't move supplies past it without it being incredibly risky.
That's a great point.
So that's really where that, because you might say, well, why would the South put cannons and forts on the Mississippi? Why just stick it in the middle of the Mississippi? Well, it kind of keeps the supplies from being able to go up and down for the North because they don't want to risk their transport ships.
Yeah, if you were going to try and stop supplies from, you know, in modern times from getting to St. Louis to Kansas City, you'd be setting up everything you can along I-70.
Yes, yes.
Well, so the Confederates come on and they smash into the Union reinforcement or the Union positions that are on the north part of Corinth. And they do actually break through. At some point, there's Rosecrans does this thing where he tries to give his right flank an order, and it's kind of an unintelligible order, and then that commander refuses to do it unless he gets confirmation in writing. And so his division actually doesn't even end up fighting in the fight, while the Confederates punch through the center of basically what's the center of the Union line. And they took the entrenchments, and then they said the Yankees ran like hens running from a hawk, hiding behind every log and in every place they could find. We followed them for a quarter mile, but they outran us, we having marched for the last 2 weeks and marching 10 miles that morning.
Yeah.
So again, the guys are tired.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Union's almost running so fast that the tired Confederates can't keep up with them.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a little bit of a pursuit. They are running out. But Lovell, on the Confederate right flank, just stops at the first line. He's done. He's not going to move anymore. Okay. So at around 5 o'clock, Van Dorn meets up with Price and says, what should we do? Should we keep pushing them? Because it seems like they're kind of broken. And it really was a great time to be aggressive and push. Mm-hmm. And usually Van Dorn, we're seeing that aggressiveness. But Price is actually the one that says, no, I think we've done enough for today. General, the men should rest. Because remember, Price is always more concerned with taking care of the soldiers. And kind of he loses perspective on that sometimes.
Yeah.
So Van Dorn's like, okay, we'll just basically sleep on our arms where we are.
Yeah.
And then we'll renew the fight in the morning. That's what we're going to do. We're going to have a plan and we'll go do our attack. The other two, Van Dorn wanted to continue. Maury wanted to continue. But in the end, Price convinces Van Dorn, we're just going to rest. So they go to sleep.
Yeah.
And they can hear that in the south of them where the Union is, wheels moving. And they're like, oh, maybe the Union troops are leaving. Maybe they're too. No, they're wheeling cannons.
Yeah.
And more troops are showing up. When I mentioned that they were pulling in these garrisons, some of these troops had marched from a long way for Rosecrans. Mm-hmm. Now they're arriving. So the Union's actually getting stronger. You're giving Rosecrans a chance to kind of reorganize, reposition his troops so he'll be ready in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan is going to be a cannonade in the morning. Hebert's division is going to charge, kind of lead off the attack. And at 4 o'clock, cannons roar out. There's this huge cannonade. And then there's no attack at daybreak. Nothing happens. So Price sends off a messenger to Hebert, like, hey, what's up, dude?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the attack? No response. They can't find him. Sends off another messenger. And this is not a big battlefield. Like, Price could just go over there. Right. But Price is probably having his breakfast or something.
Right.
Sends another messenger to Hebert. Hey, you're supposed to start off the attack. Where's the daybreak attack? No response.
Oh,
sends off another messenger. Then Hebert shows up at his tent and says, I'm sick.
Yeah.
Now later, some reporters actually accused Hebert of being under the influence of narcotics at this point. So Price is like, okay, you're relieved of duty. I'm going to put, I think it was he put Green in charge. But Green doesn't even know what the plan is. So it takes Green another couple hours to go talk to his, he was a brigade commander. Now suddenly he's in charge of the division. He's got to go meet with everybody, figure out where everybody is. So it's still now 9 a.m. and there's been no attack. Well, the Union starts sending skirmishers because they're like, what's going on?
Right.
Like, and basically those skirmishers trigger a Confederate attack. They go out there and basically kick a hornet's nest, and then the Confederates start launching their attack. They have to charge across 200 yards of open ground against these cannon redoubts. Like they're described as lunettes, which basically is because they're in the crescent of a moon, like a half crescent.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is then you have cannons positions in there, and they're really powerful positions because you've got all the cover. They can fire grape shot and canister at the guys as they're charging. The Missourians are all running across the field, and they said this is one of these Battery Powell was actually manned by the 1st Missouri Artillery, Missouri Union Artillery Unit.
And you might want to explain to the listeners what grape shot is.
Yeah, so grape shot is basically, it's like a shotgun round, basically, for a cannon. Instead of putting, normally if you had like a 12-pounder cannon, that meant you had a big round shot that weighed 12 pounds that you would put in, or some kind of shot, if it was like a smoothbore that you put in the cannon and fire it. Grape shot is where you have like a, almost like a can full of like, it could be nails. A lot of times it was little balls, like buckshot.
Type. 50 cals.
Yeah, it would just blast. When guys got close, when you got within 100, 200 yards, they would switch from firing explosives to firing canister, and it would just cut sheets of, like, just pathways
so
through
definitely
troops.
Definitely anti-personnel.
Yeah, it was like a giant shotgun. It turned your cannon into a giant shotgun.
Okay.
Now, if you want to see one of those in person, the Visitor Center at Wilson's Creek has some grape shot rounds.
Do they? Yeah.
Yeah, they look like big balls, right?
They are. Yeah. That's what it looks like, a 50 caliber smoothbore round.
Yeah.
Around.
Yeah.
And this is a quote from a guy from the 6th Missouri of what they were experiencing as they charged across these. Think about it, 2 football fields of clear terrain from the wood line where you're running across in formation with flags. Imagine being the poor guy to having to carry the flags, which a great aiming spot.
Right.
I mean, we've heard these color guards where the guys keep picking up the flags and get shot down and pick up. And then finally, the 7th guy will say, for God's sakes, don't pick up that goddamn flag again. leave it be.
You pick it up.
So the guy said, a sheet of flame leaped out from fronting rifle pits, and showers of iron and leaden hail smote the onrushing men from Missouri with terrible and deadly effect. Great gaps were torn in their ranks to be filled as soon as made. Not for a moment did they halt. Every instant death smote. It came in 100 shapes, every shape a separate horror. Here a shell, short-fused, exploded in the thinning ranks, would rend its victims and spatter their comrades with brains, flesh, and blood. Men's heads were blown to atoms. Fragments of human flesh, still quivering with life, would slap other men in the face or fall to earth to be trampled underfoot. This is one of the greatest parts about the Civil War, because this is one of the first wars where so many of the regular troops were literate. So we get these great written descriptions of things that they observed.
Well, this guy talking about blown to atoms. Now, this is 1860s, and he's saying that.
Wow. Yeah.
But for some reason, that just jumped at me. Like, atoms?
Or like quivering pieces of flesh. I mean, this guy probably went on to be a successful writer.
I mean, it is. It's amazing. All of them were so well-educated. And you know, they're not college-educated, but...
They could write letters.
The education that we provided for people with nothing but a one-room schoolhouse and a McGuffey's reader, these people were amazing. You read some of the letters from back then, and it's just almost like poetry.
You remember the education back in those days was reading, writing, arithmetic. Mm-hmm. That's all you needed to get through.
Right, yeah.
So this is how bad it was. It wasn't just canister. At this point, the Union switched to double canister. So now they're putting 2 cans of grape shot in each gun. So the Confederates are getting so close that they can actually fire double loads out of each cannon. And even the Union infantry, it's getting so hairy that their supporting infantry runs away. So it's just the cannons firing. Okay. And the Confederates actually take 13 cannon. They cut a quarter mile wide hole, these Missouri units in the Union line. Now, sad family fact for me, Colonel Maupin was killed in this charge. And apparently, once he was killed, his regiment, the 1st Dismounted Cavalry, they laid down and didn't charge. One of the guys in the unit said, I think it was the intention for us to charge it by some means. We did not do it. But that's cavalry for you, right?
Yeah. Oh my
so God. Once Colonel Maupin got knocked out, the rest of them were like, we're going to lay down and we're not going to, until someone tells us to go. We're
going to wait here.
Yeah, we'll wait it out. So the problem is, they do this great attack, and they break through in the center and on the second day. Lovell, on the other side, just moves forward a little bit and doesn't do any more attacking. So basically, the guys he's facing on the left, they're not being impressed at all. So, and that's the band. We got the band going by. So the guys on the left, they're not... being pressed at all by Lovell. And on the right side, there's guys that aren't being pressed. So what they do is they all turn their fire to the center and start just enfilading. And enfilade is when they're shooting you down your flank. So you're in a line. The worst thing that can happen is they're shooting you, like crossing the T on you.
If you're in enfilade fire, you're on the receiving end of that, your chances are pretty poor.
Yeah. I mean, it's bad enough when they're shooting you from the front in your line. There's a couple of you. But once they're shooting one round, they shoot a cannonball and down your line. They can hit 20, 30 guys and knock them all down.
Well, and even with just the rifle rounds, you know, you're still talking 40, 50 caliber rounds.
Yeah.
Well, a wound is as good as dead.
Yeah, so they're getting shot from the front.
Right.
So basically, and the problem with, I described that lunette these guys are attacking. What's the downside of the lunette once you capture it? There's no wall on the backside. Because that's how it's designed.
Right.
It's not designed so that the attacker gets cover.
Right.
So once you climb over the walls and you start driving off all the gunners, you're like, okay, we got the guns. Suddenly you're facing all these other guys shooting at you, and you're out in the open. You're just getting shot down. So they tried to hang in there for about 30 minutes, and just the fire is pouring in on the Missourians and the other units that made it with them. So they end up falling back. I mean, their officers are getting picked off. And
well, as Dr. Paisley pointed out, he said 40 and 50 caliber rounds. The majority of the rounds fired were 58 caliber mini balls.
There you go.
That literally, because I did that in competition, that's the size of your thumb.
Yeah.
Going down range.
Well, and you know, that gets into the discussion we had in the past, where if you got shot by one of these damn things, we can take you out in front of the emergency room at the hospital down here, and somebody shoots you in the arm with that.
Yeah.
They're going to cut that arm off, because the damage that something that big and moving that slow does, it doesn't break your arm. It just shatters it.
And also, these rounds are going to hit something. Because you ducked it, guess who gets it, who's standing behind you? You know, they don't just stop midway like, oh, I missed my target, I think I'll just lay down now. They're going to hit something.
And pretty much the rules about not shooting a guy on a horse, those are gone.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's, you know, heck
so,
with that.
So Price is watching, you know, he's the commander on that side, and he's watching his division, and the Missourians are running. At this point, the Missourians didn't think they'd ever lost a battle so far. They still thought they'd won at Pea Ridge as far as they were concerned, you know, because as far as they could see on their side, they had fought pretty well.
Yeah.
And so there's this bizarre scene where he's next to Van Dorn, and Price goes, "My God, my boys are running." And he's got tears in his eyes. And Van Dorn, then he tells Van Dorn, "How could they do otherwise? They had no support. They're nearly all killed." I'm like, dude, Van Dorn's next to you.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's his fault.
Right. Yeah. Dude.
So Van Dorn tries to console him.
Right. Yeah.
But it's like,
oh my God.
It's like, that's the guy.
Yeah.
You're talking to your own commander.
You're the one that's supposed to be helping him.
But again, classic Price moment. He's emotional, upset.
Oh, yeah.
Van Dorn probably said, "Here, take a hit off of this."
Right. Well, and think how long.
This might be a good theory. I think this should be Bill's book.
Well, yeah.
Marijuana and Van Dorn.
There you go. Yeah. Smoking a rope. That'd
Mary
be the name
Jane
of it.
Van
yeah.
Dorn.
But, you know, think about it. You know, think about what Price and his men had been through at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, those are his boys, literally. And, you know, the conversations around the campfires, you know, for the previous 2 years. I mean, he probably knew most of them by their first names.
Well, he was that kind of leader, too. I mean, they loved him a lot. They saw Van Dorn as a father figure to them.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, he was one of the most popular men in Missouri when he was in Missouri.
Price,
now, Bill was not there at the time. That would have reduced his popularity. So, and Dabney Morey, the center division commander, was quoted. He wrote, "I said it, I mean no disparagement to any troops in the Confederacy when I say the Missouri troops of the Army of the West were not surpassed by any troops in the world." So the Missourians, time after time, are getting compliments, you know, the way they handle themselves on the battlefield. So Van Dorn withdraws. Basically the Missourians have said, "We're done. They're not coming back." They run back to the wood line.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys are probably done for the day.
Mm-hmm.
he withdraws a little bit, and then there's a stop as they're retreating. And Price and Morey are like, "Why are we stopped?" And they go to see Van Dorn, and they're like, he's like, "Oh, I have a plan." And they're like, "What's your plan?" He goes, "I'm going to march around, and I'm going to attack Corinth from the south now." And they're like, "No, that's not happening." Like, "You are not doing that.
Doing it by yourself."
And like, again, this is maybe the weed kicking in at this point.
Yeah, that's it.
You got to wonder.
But he actually thinks he's now going to come around from the south end and try to get
him. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It could have been Jimson weed. Who knows?
Well, it could have been. Yeah.
So, Bo, the good news is the 1st Missouri didn't suffer much casualties because they were in Lovell's command that really didn't get engaged. And there's a possibility that Lovell was intentionally not getting attacking that much because he didn't think it was a good idea because he saw this open ground. There's some theories that Lovell kind of did what they call it, slow quitting, where you're like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to pretend like I'm attacking and we're not going to go.
Well, and think of the psychological effect when you're watching what's left of all the other guys, you know, and they're limping back and you're thinking, and they're saying, "Cannons up there, dude." You know,
and it was not a mystery to anybody either, because even when you look at the casualty numbers, it was clear that Lovell's troops hadn't been as hotly engaged. So there's now a lot of resentment in the army about who.
Where were you?
Plus, Bowen was in the Lovell's division, kept sending messages, "Hey, are we going to advance or not? What is going on?" It kept sending messages back. So Bowen's brigade is left as the rear guard with the 1st Missouri, as always. So they're basically covering for the army. This is what they did at Shiloh. This is what they end up doing in almost all these battles because they're reliable.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're kind of trying to keep the enemy off. The problem is Van Dorn has to cross the Hatchie River. As he's going to cross it at a bridge, there's Union troops on the other side. Hurlbut showed up with troops. They can't get across the bridge now because they're there. Meanwhile, McPherson is pursuing them, so they're about to get trapped between two forces and destroyed. Luckily, there was this one commander, a cavalry commander, who was seizing a dam a little bit south down the river. He was supposed to destroy it, but when he heard the shooting up by the bridge, he thought, maybe I shouldn't destroy this dam. Maybe I should see what's going up there. Mm-hmm. And when he went up there, he said, hey, you know, I think we can build a bridge over this dam, and we can actually get across this way. So Price goes down there and checks it out. Price starts helping. They start building this bridge. Price gets off his horse, starts directing guys, climbs into the water, starts fixing it, helping them put stones in different spots. And eventually the whole army manages to escape across that bridge that they build in the middle of the night. It's like 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. And then escape down south and get out of the battle, where they were probably minutes away from being destroyed, trapped and destroyed after the battle. This is, again, the disadvantage behind moving behind your enemy and attacking your enemy from behind, thereby putting the enemy you're attacking behind you also. Mm-hmm. So it's like Van Dorn seems to always like this, I'm in the enemy's rear. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, yeah, but now your rear is exposed.
That's right.
So yeah, they make it back to Holly Springs. Yeah, so the Confederate casualties, the two Missouri brigades lost a total of about 800 men. Mm-hmm. Lovell's entire division lost 359.
Wow.
So that shows you some of the differences there. 4,800 Confederate casualties versus 3,100 Union. Mm. So the Confederates lost 1,700 more men in the battle. And afterwards, Bowen brings formal charges against Van Dorn of gross neglect of duty. I mean, basically, this time they're like, that's it. We're going to hold you accountable for this. Right. But he was exonerated. They weren't able to actually prove. I guess you needed a lot of evidence to prove that somebody was neglectful. If Bill had been on that jury, I think it would have been no problem. Well,
it would have been a firing squad.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and here again, you know, it's the aftermath of these battles that you got to step back and think, okay, how many horses did they lose? How much supplies?
Ammunition lost.
You know, of the 4,800 casualties, what are you going to do with them?
Also, all the officers.
What do you do if you've got 3,000 men down with a 50 caliber round injury?
Yeah. In each one of these bloody battles, you're losing leaders, right? The guys who have to.
Right.
And also the bravest of the brave, your sergeants and troops who lead the way, they're getting mowed down. Well, and then the ones who aren't as brave are like, they're the ones that are left.
Right. Yeah. Guess what? Yeah. But, you know, again, you know, you think about it, you know, they're setting up field hospitals and whatever barns they can find. The only medicine they had basically was to cut a limb off. And then because they didn't have antibiotics and all that, the standard procedure was to pack it in cow manure and wrap it up.
Pray,
you know,
pray on it.
You know, so yeah, there was a lot of that. Like mom used to be, rub some dirt on it, you'll be okay. But yeah, you know, when you know, it was the casualties that came months later, infection.
You touched on a great thing too, the arms, because 58 caliber or 50 caliber, that's all there is. It's either, you know, it's not, well, this is a 7.62 and that's a whatever. Mm-hmm. You can go pick up all of that ammo. Black powder is black powder is black powder. Mm-hmm. And if you're the loser and you left it on the field, it's going to be coming back at you in the future.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, so at the end of the battle, Rosecrans was walking around the battlefield. He ran into an Arkansas lieutenant who had a mangled foot and was like kind of leaning up against a tree. And he said, he offered him some water, and the lieutenant declined. He said, thank you, General. One of your men just gave me some. And Rosecrans said, it was pretty hot fighting. And the Arkansas lieutenant said, yeah, General, you licked us good, but we gave you the best we had in the ranch.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So I thought that was a great quote.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. Unbelievable.
So the next thing we could talk about is Vicksburg, because that's kind of what's going to come up after this one. That's the Battle of Corinth in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, it's a classic battle, really, at Corinth, you know, in that... you know, the amazing thing about it is
when people don't know a lot about it.
Right. And you sit there and you think, Well, you know, this is a huge battle, and the losses you just talked about, you know, you can full well imagine. I mean, even after they separate at the end of this, they're not that far from one another. And you're talking, you know, somewhere around 10,000 casualties if you add the two groups together. And this happened on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. It's not like in the American Revolution where they'd have a fight and then it would be months before another fight would break out. Sometimes, you know, almost a year. That was the horrendous thing about the Civil War. These dispatches are coming back to Washington, to Lincoln, and they're coming every other day with losses this bad and worse.
For these armies alone, 1862, you've got Shiloh, Iuka, and Corinth. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are three battles that the Missourians have fought in, mm-hmm. just in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot.
Yeah, so it's not surprising when you do your family
in fact,
tree.
P. Ridge, too. Wasn't P. Ridge right P. in the Ridge. Beginning of 1862? Yeah. So it's four battles.
When you're doing your research on your family.
I'm sorry, Elkhorn Tavern.
Yes, and you, yeah, well, it depends on how you do it.
I think we would call it Elkhorn Tavern.
But the thing is when you look at that and you start doing your genealogy, you can see, you know, the odds are pretty good that somebody that you knew was killed or maimed in one of those battles, because the numbers are astronomical, way beyond anything that we can even comprehend in this day and age.
We can't comprehend it.
No.
Especially on our own soil.
Right.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing about when they talk about these battles and the American casualties. Now, a lot of these battles have record American casualties in a day because both sides are technically American, right?
That's a great point to make, you know, in that no matter who gets shot, it's an American goes down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read somewhere where that was the highest percentage of population of casualties for the United States than any war we've been in, World War I and World War II included.
Yeah.
Because, again, on either side, it's an American that falls.
Yeah. I can't separate the two myself. I see it as American soldier death, mm-hmm. whether you're a CSA soldier or you're a USA soldier. It's still all American soldiers.
Well, technically, there's an A in both of those, right?
So that's
the A stands for America.
Yeah, yeah.
So the main character for this part, the chapter of Vicksburg, is Pemberton.
Pemberton. Mm-hmm. I might make a suggestion.
Sure.
That we treat Vicksburg as a whole separate show. Because I think we're going to get into deep, deep, deep stuff.
Well, I think we can lead up to it. Let's set the stage for it, and then we don't have to really... Like, Pemberton's kind of an interesting character because he's one of these guys who's not a Southerner.
Right.
He's from Philadelphia. But he married a Virginia girl.
Yeah.
And you see some of these guys, I don't know if they tend to try hard because people are suspicious of them.
You think you have arguments with your wife. Can you imagine, you know?
Yeah.
And she's got three brothers that are all from the South. And I mean, good grief.
I mean, I don't know that he was a remarkable guy. He was more of an engineer type.
Great organizer.
He was West Point, 27 out of 50 in his class.
There you go.
Not bad, middle of the class.
Right. Yeah.
One of the interesting things I thought with this was Price again goes to Pemberton and says, hey, can I take my Missouri troops back after Corinth? He's like, can we now go back to, because Pemberton's put in charge now of this theater. Yeah. He's going to be handling Vicksburg. Van Dorn's not going to be in charge as much anymore. I think they're done after Corinth with Van Dorn. So Pemberton's like, yeah, sure. And he talks to some of his commanders, talks to Lovell, mm-hmm. who we don't like. And Lovell said, no, the Missourians are terrible. They're mob. They've no discipline. You'd be better off without them. Mm. And so Pemberton's like, okay. So he sends a message off to Richmond and says, yeah, that's no problem. I'm totally fine with you sending the Missourians back. I don't really need them. They'll be okay. Then he says, you know what? I think I'm going to take a look. Maybe I should check on these guys and check them before I let them go. Mm-hmm. So he goes up where they're training at Holly Springs, and they've heard that Lovell was talking bad about them. So the Missouri troops are in fine form, and they're marching, and they're drilling. And suddenly Pemberton's like, oh, no, I've made a terrible mistake.
Excellent shot.
Yeah. He's like, I need these guys. They're motivated. They seem to be really good. So he immediately has to send another message back to Richmond, like, hey, remember that message I said about letting the Missourians? And again, the problem that Price always seems to have is everyone's always like, no, you can go. Mm-hmm. We're not letting you take your Missourians with you, though. The Missourians are going to stay here.
Yeah.
So And it's a problem for them because the Missouri troops, again, are starting to hear all these horror stories about what's happening back in Missouri. They're sure. reading newspapers.
Sure.
And they're not getting support from their home state the way the other states right. give. Like if you're a Louisiana troops, you get supplies from Louisiana. You get right. new uniforms. If you're a Mississippi soldier, you get stuff from Mississippi. Missouri's not sending any supplies.
And Missouri's out. Under martial law.
Yeah.
And so they're hearing these horror stories where, you know, these Union troops are coming in and just wiping out people's farms. They're slaughtering people. They were shipping women off to prisons, you know.
I think we got a call in here.
All right.
Hello, caller.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
You too, Professor Paisley.
Oh, nice. He knows you well.
Yeah.
What's your favorite brand of scotch? I'd like to have a drink of scotch with you neatly.
Free is my favorite brand. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I could really tell some stories then.
You're in the club. So I'm obviously the reason I'm calling is, how did we let it get to this point? Why do we have to fight? Why do we have to kill, you know, our cousins and our brothers and our kin? What happened?
Well, this is an interesting question, probably one of the best ones we've had, in that a lot of people want to say it's fought over slavery, but these Missouri boys, most of them didn't own slaves.
Yeah, I just got in a bar argument about this exact thing at Happy Hour.
The issue that comes up is, does the federal government have the right to tell a state what to do? And isn't it interesting that right now we're in the throes of this with, you know, Trump's putting, you know, troops in D.C. and he's offering to send federal troops into places like Chicago and Baltimore. But the problem with that is the state has to authorize it. And so basically these Union troops are coming into these southern states and they're saying, what gives you the right to come in here and shoot our people? And so it comes down to the states' rights thing. And then that's a big problem. That's a huge problem.
It's a violation of posse comitatus.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it's a Occam's razor, you know.
Yes.
We're on a fine right now, and mm-hmm. and so what I think what we have to do is just be open to information, mm-hmm. and that's what you guys are doing right now. You guys on this radio station with JR and everyone else, you are just providing an open door for information that people can gather and use and decipher and discern how they want to view things.
Thank you, caller. You get it. Yeah. You get it. That's exactly why we do it.
Right. So have a great night.
Well, I'll just
jump off my soapbox.
I can't thank you enough for calling. And like I say, you know, that's really, you know, the whole purpose of us doing these shows is to just try and educate people to do your own research and, you know, draw your own opinion.
It's the key. It's the information war, you know, and war is a tough word to use, but really right now we are in an info war, and mm-hmm. just the only way this war will be won is by providing basic, honest information without any left or right bias.
Amen. So, amen.
Yeah. All right, brother. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Professor. Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite brand of scotch, too.
Yeah.
Free.
It's pretty good.
You bet. Yeah. That was a great call. You know, and that he hit the big question. And, you know, that's, you know, think about that. None of these boys that are charging into grape shot canisters in front of these cannons, the furthest thing from their mind is slavery.
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, I mean, why are they doing it?
And the point I would make is, they had slavery.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't secede to have slavery.
No.
Slavery
no.
was legal in the southern
yes.
states. So to say that they were seceding for slavery, one of the reasons they weren't happy was they saw that they were losing political power. They were in danger of, and it wasn't just slave issues. It was a lot of other issues with trade and other
absolutely.
Influence. They could slowly see that they were in a similar to how it is now, where you've got two parties that are very closely matched in their what they can get done because of the percentages of who's in each party. The South was seeing that they were in a position where they were going to, as time went on and the country expanded to the West, they were eventually going to be outnumbered, and they were not going to be able to get things what they wanted to get done.
Well, Dr. Mitchum, in another one of his books talking about the Civil War, he goes into great detail about just what you said, the economy. I mean, the South, cotton's king, but the South doesn't have all the shipping and all the marketing and everything else. That's being handled by the North. And what was happening is the North was cutting these great deals for themselves, where they're making the money, and the South is basically, you know, they have slavery, but they're using the slaves to work the fields to make the cotton, and all the money's being made up north by the shippers and the insurers and the rest of them. Yeah. And in these trade deals that they were doing with tariffs, you know, again, history repeats itself. I mean, it basically put the South in a situation where they're saying the North has a stranglehold on us, and now they're bringing in troops down here to tell us if they can tell us what we can do as far as our labor force, and that's basically what it was, and our property, because they had ruled that slaves were property. Well, then they're basically throwing the Constitution out the window, life, liberty, and property. Well,
they're saying this is not the union that we signed up for.
That's exactly right. And so when you get into the whole states' rights thing, that's where it really gets interesting. And
I mean, I think war could have been avoided to some extent if, the problem is the Union still occupied certain fortifications and positions within what we would consider Southern territory. Mm-hmm. And the Union was not inclined to abandon a lot. Some cases they did, but like Fort Sumter, they weren't going to abandon that. And so there were certain fortifications that they were just not going to give up. And then maybe if negotiations had gone on, that could have been done, but people
when you're talking about the negotiations, and this is another key point that you guys are bringing up, is the fact that, you know, in the South, you know, 99% of the people didn't own slaves. It was the big plantations. Well, the guys that didn't own slaves, they're out there with their wife and their kids working these cotton fields, doing what they can. They may have had one slave if they were very, you know, made a lot of money at it, but most people couldn't afford a slave. They were $3,000-$4,000. But what happened was, is the only people that had the time and the money to be the politicians to represent the South, yeah, were the big plantation, yeah, owners. Sure. Well, then you start talking about tariffs. You're talking about profit margins. Well, profit margins don't mean diddly squat to a guy with his wife and two kids trying to, you know, work a 40-acre farm. They make a huge difference to somebody that's got 3,000 acres of cotton and you know, 600 slaves.
Well, and people identified them, too, by what states they were from. Right. We talked about this, yes, last time. We weren't a nation where you would travel to New York City if you lived in Missouri. You know, Missouri was what you knew. You might have come in from a different state, but if you live in Mississippi is probably where you stay most of the time. Now, and so when you hear about guys from New York, they might as well be from a foreign country if a, exactly, New Yorker shows up in your hometown.
And they talk funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to say something controversial here. So you guys get ready. You can hang me if you want.
Should I do the mute
button? No, but when we were talking about Missouri and slavery and all that in our classes, I told my students one time, they said, you know, well, what about the abuse of the slaves? And don't get me wrong, slavery is wrong. It's not right. But they made it sound like, you know, all the Southerners did was on a regular basis take a whip or a stick and beat the heck out of their slaves. Well, I finally had to explain it to them. I said, I'm going to pick one student in a class. I'm going to give you a brand new Corvette. But the stipulation is that you have to drive it to class every week. And when you get out of the car in a parking lot, you have to take a ball peen hammer out and hit it. And they're all like, what? And I said, whoever wins this car, you got to beat it. You know, and I want you to smash window, put dents in it through the fiberglass. And they're like, what in the world? And I said, what's wrong with that? And they said, well, you're harming the value of the car. And it's not going to be worth anything. And I said, bingo, you got it. I said, that was the same mindset with slaves. It wasn't necessarily that they that the plantation owners cared for the slave as much as it is that's an asset. It's something that has value. And like I said, a slave would go for anywhere from $2,500 to $3,500. This is when you could buy 160 acres of land for $40. So what would happen is, you know, slave owners, if you beat your slaves, your neighbors would say, what in the world is wrong with that guy? He's damaging a $3,500 piece of property. Now, I know that doesn't sound right, but from an economic standpoint, that's exactly what they thought. When a slave gets sick, they would give him medicine. When there was something wrong with him, they took care of him. They housed him. They fed him. But they didn't do it out of love for the slave. They did it out of the fact that it's a valuable piece of property.
And they even educated some of them.
Yes, yes. And that was the thing. Then all of a sudden, you know, you've got these northerners are coming in and saying, we're going to take that property away from you.
Well, the other thing is a lot of the northern troops were not fighting for slavery.
No. Not
they
at
were
all.
Fighting, they thought, to restore the Union.
Exactly.
You know, when you see what a lot of Northern soldiers wrote, they were not interested in, they were not abolitionists. Or I mean, that's why they were called abolitionists, because it was a separate belief than what the Republicans believed.
Even Lincoln himself, when he ran for president, he said, I will not do away with slavery where it currently exists. He said in the Lincoln-Douglas debates that he just wanted to stop it from expanding further west. And so, you know, it becomes a huge issue, but it wasn't for 99% of the people fighting for the South, because they didn't own slaves. They couldn't relate to it at all. All they want to do is, all they know is that all of a sudden, here's 70,000 Union troops have come into my state, and they're shooting at us. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, we got to go back and put it into perspective, too. By the time the Civil War started, mm-hmm. we hadn't even been a country for 100 years.
No. Yeah.
And the slave states, that was their identity.
Right.
That's what we come in under. That's what we knew. Let us not forget that George Washington had slaves. Thomas Jefferson had slaves.
Bingo.
John Adams had slaves.
Yes.
When we go down the list of all the early presidents, up to Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And they had slaves.
And we're not condoning it, folks.
No.
But we're saying it was just a way of doing business back then. And then all of a sudden, you know, we've had the North that's controlling the businesses, and they're putting an economic hardship on the South. And all of a sudden, the next thing you know, there's troops there. And like I say, the 99% of the people didn't have slaves. They didn't work on a plantation. But now all of a sudden, they're seeing all of our supplies are being cut off. That's another key point here. This river access, understand that the Southerners, they knew they could make money on cotton. We were selling it all to England. But the way they did it is they got the cotton. All they had to do is get it to the ports. They'd ship it up the river, or they'd ship it up, you know, off the East Coast. Then Northern ships would haul it off to England and sell it for them. And tobacco. Well, because of that, because that's where you could make your money, the Southerners gave up growing corn and beans and things you could eat. They didn't raise cattle. Everybody raised cotton. Cotton truly was king. And so where did they get their food? From the North. And so as soon as the war breaks out, now all of a sudden that poor guy and his wife and two kids.
Or the Midwest, too. Midwest.
Yes.
When you say North, you're referring to all.
Yes. They have no food supplies coming in. They have no manufactured goods coming in. They've got nothing. I mean, really, when you think about it, the South picking this, or, you know, going into this conflict with, they have no manufacturing. They have no food. All they have is cotton and tobacco. That's it. And
I mean, when you think about it, like, why else would all these Missourians swear an oath to fight for the Confederate States when here their state hadn't even really officially seceded? I mean, it did secede.
And we'd only been a state for 40 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
We'd only been a pawn for 40 years.
And that's exactly right. So again, you know, like our caller was saying earlier, it's interesting, you know, we don't have the answers, you know, but what it does is I'm hoping it gets our listeners to thinking, wow, You know, why did these guys do that?
Well, I think war starts too, because like I said, people don't understand each other very well. Like when we talk about West Point, the reason West Point was so remarkable, you'd have all these guys coming, young men coming from all over the country, mm-hmm. Texas, Alabama, New York, Vermont, and they're all mixing at the school. Mm-hmm. Like when the Louisiana Tigers even marched into Richmond for the Army of the Potomac, people were like, oh my God, they thought these guys might have been from a foreign country. They were so crazy looking mm-hmm. with their pants. And it was like a circus atmosphere. Like yeah. as all these foreign from other state troops started marching through Richmond to come help Virginia.
And LSU hasn't changed at all.
Right. Well, I've not seen Louisianans have changed.
And folks, I'm sitting here across from Dave, and he's got a shirt on, a Mizzou dad with a tiger on it. And again, I don't know that most people realize this. During the Civil War, Columbia was terrified they were going to get raided by mm-hmm. these guerrillas coming in, you know, Quantrell and the whole gang. So they formed a militia unit, and they had basically a little bulk house that they built right there on Broadway in downtown Columbia, right by the bank. And that's where the militia would meet, and they would patrol the streets. And that militia's name was the Tigers. And that's where Missouri got its name, Missouri Tigers.
That's right.
Yeah. So, again, you know, Missouri history right there for you folks.
Yeah. I took a course in Missouri history at Mizzou.
Did you now?
And
we can only imagine yeah. how this went.
Yeah. No, it really went well, and we did a walking tour, and that was one of the places that we went and looked at.
I thought it was going to be about you arguing with your professor or something.
I did. Still yet. I mean, yeah. it don't matter.
No. Never could teach that old man anything, could he?
All right. So we got Pemberton.
Right.
And so that's what we're talking about, different states, right? It is a big deal that Pemberton's not from a southern state. Right. He doesn't talk the way the other guys talk. You know, there's a difference. They can mm-hmm. tell. They never really like Pemberton. Even his subordinates always kind of like, Jeff Davis kind of likes him. Why? Because Pemberton does what Jeff Davis yeah. says to do. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Davis knows that he's reliable for him. He's not going to be like Price or some other guy who's going to or Joe Johnston, who's not going to do what he's told.
Well, he's a good lapdog is what he is.
Right. Yeah.
So, and it's a big deal. Protecting Vicksburg is a big deal for Jeff Davis because Jeff Davis is from Mississippi, mm-hmm. right? So this is he's concerned mm-hmm. about his own properties, his own family's welfare. They're back there. And here's where we see the first Missouri get transferred in with the rest. So where they fought at Corinth separately, now they're transferred in with all the other Missouri regiments. And Bowen actually gets his own division. So he's moved up from being a regimental commander, a brigade commander, to now he's a division commander. So he's got all the Missouri guys under him. We've got the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th Missouri infantry. 1st and 3rd dismounted cav. Remember, the 2nd cav is going to go off. They were actually allowed to remount. They got mm-hmm. their horses back.
Yeah.
And they would go off later and fight with Forrest.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the artillery. Gibo, one of my favorite artillery battery names. The Jackson artillery, the St. Louis artillery, and Landis's battery.
There you go.
And he's also got Cockrell.
Yes.
That's right, Cockrell.
One of my favorite yes. commanders.
Cockrell's in there. I talked in the first episode about how it gets confusing. The Cavalry Brigade had the 2nd Missouri Cavalry and Clark's Battery, which is commanded by King. Because Clark's still called Clark's Battery.
Yeah,
okay.
Cool figure.
So the first and 4th Missouri get consolidated at this point because of casualties at Corinth. Mm-hmm. They start getting into situations where you'll see them sometimes listed as 1st/4th. Mm-hmm. So what do they do with the extra officers? They actually get sent back to Missouri to serve with Shelby and Marmaduke. Mm-hmm. So those guys are going to be given commands mm-hmm. with the cavalry in Missouri. Price again writes a letter to Richmond. Hey, remember, we're supposed to be going back to Missouri. Right. I haven't heard yeah. anything back. Dear Jeff Davis, remember right. your promise. And Pemberton again says, no, I need the Missouri guys. We're not sending mm-hmm. them back. Instead, I'm going to make Van Dorn my 1st Corps commander, and I'm going to make Price my 2nd Corps commander. So that's how Pemberton's now going to set up his army. And it's starting to become a concern with the Missouri troops to where Price has to actually issue an order saying, hey, don't desert. I know bad stuff's happening back in Missouri. Don't give up hope. You know, I'll stay here with you. You know, it's going to be, we swore an oath to fight for the Confederacy. And General Joe Johnston's put in overall command. So Pemberton's in charge kind of what's going on in Mississippi and around Vicksburg, but Joe Johnston is now the overall commander of everything going on in the West. Pemberton has 21,000 troops, and he gets 10,000 troops from Bragg right before Bragg fights the Battle of Stones River, and Bragg could have probably really used those 10,000 troops in that fight.
You get that,
but too
right.
bad they're going to see Pemberton, so he doesn't get those. And I guess we can do real quick if we wanted. So Grant, there's a couple attempts by Grant to take Vicksburg, and I'll do the quick one for the Holly Springs one. Grant first tries to come down the east side on the railroad line, and he's using this narrow railroad line to supply himself. And Forrest and Van Dorn actually gets a cavalry command, and they go raid Holly Springs, and they basically burn and loot all of Grant's supplies. They get around behind Grant and just tear up all his stuff. So it's so bad that Grant realizes, I got to go back north. I can't do the attack. So Grant has to put his tail between his legs and march back up north.
No, because his supply depot was Memphis.
Yeah, right. So that cut him off pretty much.
He was in a bad position.
Well, and if I could help here, as far as trying to envision the situation here where Vicksburg is, again, we've got supplies coming down from the north, and they're ideally, if they can get past Vicksburg, then they can connect to New Orleans, and they can feed everybody, the entire Northern Army. Think of it this way. Let's see if we can do this. Think of Warsaw, Missouri being Chicago, okay? And that's where the Northern has all the supplies. But they need to get all those supplies all the way down to Bagnell Dam, south of Vicksburg, basically. So think of these boats coming, and they finally come all the way down, snake through the lake, and they come to terrain that's almost identical to what we have where Horseshoe Bend is.
Yep.
Now they've got to turn around and go from like the where Lodge of the Four Seasons is. They've got a boat all the way up around that point of Horseshoe Bend, make the turn in front of Millstone, and head to the dam. Okay. Now that's with these steamboats unprotected with all the supplies. Vicksburg would be like where Millstone is. It's on the North Shore side, but they have clear vision. So any boats that are going to come down the lake and go around the end of Horseshoe Bend, it go right in front of Millstone or Vicksburg.
Yeah,
that's exactly the same situation that they had on the Mississippi. The Mississippi right there comes down and for some weird reason has this huge bend in it. And the bend...
They have to slow down.
Yes, and the top of the bend is... On the opposite shore is where Vicksburg is, and it's sitting high up on a river bluffs.
I mean, the big advantage when we're talking about these forts, right? Fort shooting at a ship. The biggest advantage of the fort is you can't sink a fort.
Right, exactly.
Right, so the fort can just keep shelling you.
Yes.
And you know, even when we're talking about stuff like ironclads, so when you were going to try to go up and shell a fort, sometimes they would be like, we're going to blast this fort.
Right.
And like in New Orleans, they were able to do that. They could go up to the forts and knock them out, basically knock out all the guns.
Right.
But like against Vicksburg would have timber and wood on the backside that they would light so that then it was backlighting all the ironclads so you could see them all as they were coming. The ironclads would have to pull up. They have iron.
Yeah.
But you're inside this boiling, steaming, smoky ship. And the guns don't magically shoot through the armor. Well, you have these gun ports you have to open. Well, the Confederates have like 200 sharpshooters and rifle pits that are waiting to shoot every time they see you open up one of those little those little portholes to fire. They see the cannon come out. Well, then they start shooting in.
And you're sitting down on the water and shooting up.
Yeah.
You know, which is a whole nother problem now.
Yeah. And they have plunging fire on you.
Are we too early to talk about the canal?
Let's
just.
All right. We'll hold off
we'll get
on
to,
that.
I think we'll get to the other
stuff. But eventually, you know, they're going to look at it and say, you know, this is suicide going around this dang thing.
Well,
so,
and, you know, Dave brought the point about the ironclad. It was only ironclad to the waterline.
Right.
Right.
Then it's wood.
Right, and every round that comes in and hits that iron, there's wood on the other side. There's splinters flying inside that thing. It's got smokestacks. Get what? They get shot off this, what happens when you got your smoke going out well, and suddenly your smoke shack gets shut off?
And how much stuff can you put in it? You brought this up earlier. I mean, the key to getting this river is so you can get supplies down. Right. Well, in an ironclad, you'd be lucky if you can carry, you know, two boxes of goods with you, just enough to feed the troops that are in it.
Listeners, we'll get into some really good ship stuff at Vicksburg.
Yeah.
Something you brought up earlier about transport ships versus ironclads.
Yeah.
There's a really big story there.
Yeah, great. And bear in mind, at this point in time in Missouri, you know, everything in Missouri was traveling by steamship.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the war breaks out and the Union has control, now, you know, it was suicide to get on a steamship because, again, the steamships that are trying to supply Kansas City are running a gauntlet because the guerrillas are sitting up on these bluffs in places like Jeff City and Boonville, et cetera. And when the boat comes, they're just peppering the living daylights out of the control rooms.
But even like from the Confederate perspective, you know, once you know that the Union gunboats are operated, say they've taken out the fort, you can't even camp near the river anymore because you might be sleeping there one night and you wake up, suddenly a gunboat comes right. Or if you're trying to cross the Mississippi, there were times where they were trying to get across and they suddenly have to be like, oh no, two gunboats come around the corner.
Right. Well, and folks think about this too. Think from the standpoint in modern times, you know, we saw what happened. When was it? 93, when we had all those floods.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time my wife was working in Columbia. Well, all that around Jeff City flooded down by the airport and all that. There wasn't any way to get across. And it literally, she was having to drive all the way to Boonville, come down the back way, down 179 that way to get around. But even that bridge on the other side of it, it eventually flooded, and it isolated her from being able to go to work. Well, you think there's two bridges there, all right? So think of it from the standpoint of, logistically, in the 1860s, if you have control of any of the river crossings, which were very few, any of the shallow spots where you could get across, well, you've got control of the whole thing. You're cutting off a major highway. And even today, think about it. If you dropped the bridges at St. Louis across the Mississippi, you dropped the two there at the Missouri River out by St. Charles, you know, just run down the list. It wouldn't be very many. You take out, look what happens now. You know, I work in Camdenton, and you have a wreck on the Grand Glaze Bridge. Now what?
Yeah.
You know, I think what you got to do to get around it. So this is key. I can't emphasize it enough that this gaining control of this river access is huge to both sides. Huge. And it really, Vicksburg is going to be, in my opinion, one of the biggest turning points.
And as we talk next time about, there's a lot of layers to Vicksburg. Oh, mm-hmm. my gosh. Mm-hmm. And a lot of battles.
Yeah, a lot of reasons why it was such a hard nut to crack. Yeah.
And it wasn't just the fact that, you know, we got this siege mentality. Oh, no. They're coming out of Vicksburg and engaging outside of Vicksburg a goodly distance. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of terrain around Vicksburg that makes it hard to take, mm-hmm. to capture.
But again, I sit there and, you know, look at it from the standpoint of the people themselves. I think about what was happening to the people here in Missouri under martial law, and then I can't even begin to comprehend. You live in Osage Beach and wake up tomorrow and you're surrounded by 70,000 troops. And you got no way out. No way out.
Well, yeah, like a holiday weekend.
Yeah, kind of like, it is. It's kind of like what's coming this weekend.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, and like I say, when we get into that battle, you know, I'll bring you some information about what's happened, what it was like for the people that were there, because a lot of people forget that as well.
Well, I think that's going to be a big part of our next discussion, mm-hmm. because this is when those two factions collide, the citizen faction and the military faction, and it collides in a huge way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think not until the siege of Richmond or Petersburg do you see anything similar, right, where it's, there weren't a lot of sieges. That was the interesting thing about Vicksburg, is it combines a lot of new aspects of warfare for American warfare, where mm-hmm. it's a siege, It's also a river fortress. There's ironclads involved. These are all things that had never been used in American warfare before. And here they're all coming together. And so you're going to see a lot of ingenuity and how modern science and metallurgy and metallurgy. But it all comes together. They're kind of like new technology really starts becoming used for a lot of this.
Well, and I think tactics as well. You know, they still teach all of, you know, this is huge in West Point and our military academies.
It's also why it's one of the hardest battles to understand, I think, because it is, most of them are pretty straightforward. Hey, we lined up, we fought, and this line fought against this line, and they won here. This one, there's a lot of pieces where you, how do you, you know, it's a fort. You can't just attack it. Then you got to isolate it. How do you isolate it? Well, it can get supplies by water and by land. So you have to kind of, how do you surround a fort like this?
And we'll bring Sherman into the mix too.
Oh yeah. That's true. Yeah. But you know, think about it. History does repeat itself in that the American Revolution, we have Cornwallis got himself down there at Yorktown. Yeah. And the same thing. They laid siege to him. Charleston in the early years of the American Revolution, same thing, a city sitting there, you know, on a bay with river on both sides of it. All you got to do is block them off and keep them from getting supplies. But the problem was, is nobody could figure out, like you say, it's one thing to lay a siege. What's the tactic to finishing this dang thing?
Right.
And that was the key. And I think when we get to the point of the Civil War with what you were saying, Dave, with the technology that we have, the weapons that you had, then all of a sudden it's a whole different ballgame. They know how to finish this thing off.
Well, at some point Pemberton's going to have a choice whether he wants to maneuver or fall back into Vicksburg. And I think it's not a coincidence that Grant, you know, in a lot of these battles, there's casualties. Say, I lost 8,000, they lost 7,000. Mm-hmm. Grant is the one general that has twice and arguably three times captured entire enemy armies. Like, if your goal is to destroy the enemy in warfare, Grant did it at Donelson, and he does it again at Vicksburg, and then arguably he does it again at Appomattox with Richmond.
But wasn't it at this point that, you know, again, I think you brought it up earlier about what the people were thinking about the casualties and all, and that I think it was the media at this point, you know, the printed media gave him the nickname the Butcher because the losses were so high.
So that was definitely towards the Petersburg camp, Cold Harbor battles like that, the Wilderness.
Yeah.
This is and just talking about what's going on in other areas, you know, so as we're getting ready to come to Vicksburg, we have Chancellorsville, a huge victory in the East. Mm-hmm. And so at some point there was even discussions with Lee where they were like, maybe we should send two divisions from the Army of the Potomac to go help out and try to save Vicksburg. And Lee's like, no, I got these great plans. I was thinking of doing this invasion of the North so I could really use these guys.
Bingo. You know, and I was wondering if you're going to get to that because, while this is going on, and I'm telling you, folks, this is the exact same time.
Because
this isn't Lee's, like 6 months before or after. This is while... Yeah. While we're setting up for this battle at Vicksburg, Lee has his huge army.
And Fredericksburg? He wins at Fredericksburg, crushes the Union at Fredericksburg, wins at Chancellorsville right after that. So
he's heading north.
The Union fortunes are down.
Right.
Oh, big time.
Like, and people are really starting to ask if this war was a good idea at all.
And again, you know, you got to wonder who the teacher was at West Point, because what's Lee going to do? His idea is to go up through Pennsylvania and come around behind Washington. Well, so you had Southern troops heading against Northern troops. The Northern troops are to the south, and the Southern troops are to the north. And you know, so again, where this keeps coming up, where these guys think, we'll get around behind them.
Same. They were all taught at the same school.
They're all at the same school, but I'm thinking, dudes, you know, this hasn't worked, you know.
Well, and this is, we're not going to go too much longer, now we can just go completely off the rails. But the other thing I was noticing is what you see in a lot of these situations like this one and other battles is where they try to do a sneak attack. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that they're going to sneak up on somebody. And Shiloh, they achieved surprise. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of because the armies were new. They weren't as good at putting out pickets and having cavalry posted. But you see in this case in Corinth, Rosecrans is aware that Van Dorn thinks he's going to do this giant maneuver. and come around and take them. They would never think I would come from the north. Well, no, they see it coming a mile away. Exactly. They're ready. They're waiting for it to come. And Rosecrans is still suspicious because I think he's like, Van Dorn couldn't be this dumb.
Yeah.
So I'm still going to keep one division down in the south just in case he surprises me. But nope, there he is. It was just what I thought.
He is that dumb.
And it just goes to show you, though, how remarkable Jackson was, Stonewall Jackson, at second Bull Run and at Chancellorsville, when he was able to take basically an entire corps and hide it to where, I mean, in Chancellorsville, they had no idea Jackson was, they thought he was retreating.
Yeah.
And they had no idea that he was parked perpendicular to the 11th Corps at Chancellorsville until they came howling out of the woods and just crushed Flying Dutchman.
Arguably, the Battle of Gettysburg was a surprise.
Yeah.
But again, they didn't pull it off.
No, but
They tried.
They did pretty well. Think of what J.N.O. Buford hadn't decided to ride out a ways from the town and go, oh my.
Well, on day two, day two, Longstreet's attack was supposed to be more of a surprise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the signal tower saw them. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they backed out and came around a different direction, kind of. But it's hard to do, it's hard to move. If your enemy is using their cavalry properly and putting pickets out, you know, pickets are like skirmishers that you send out a screen. You take one company and say, hey, you 100 guys, go scatter out there individually and see if you see any enemy troops.
Yeah, Lee had a little problem with that, didn't he?
Well, yeah, your cavalry is your eyes. And if the cavalry is not reporting, you've got problems.
But it does show, like for Jackson, that 1863 was pretty late in the war. And for him to be able to pull off such a total surprise like that, you just don't see it. You see guys try it over and over again, and it doesn't work. Though, again, I would say when you look at Wilson's Creek was a surprise.
Yeah.
But again, they were so new in the war, they're still camping. They just happened to run into a Confederate cavalry unit that was camping as Lyon's coming in, and that kind of gives the alert. They run around, and that's how they detect them. But, I mean, they basically almost marched up onto Price when he didn't even know they were coming.
Yeah, see, that's always been my argument with Price, because he just was not prepared for that day.
Well, you know, at West Point, you know, the texts that they were using, most of the tactics, they're coming straight out of the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
And so that's what they were studying, is how Napoleon did it. And Napoleon was the great tactician for that move, the surprise you were talking about.
Yeah,
his ability to
move
troops.
He was big on flanking.
Yes.
Napoleon's other strategy was attack on the right flank, attack on the left flank, and wait till they start sending reserves, and then hit him in the middle, which is kind of what Lee tried to do at Gettysburg.
And, you know, a lot of it, when you look at it, you can go back and look at some of the great battles that Napoleon had, and they're repeating themselves here in the Civil War.
Yeah.
The big difference is the technology you talked about. That's the difference. You know, God, if Napoleon had the technology, you know, then we'd all be speaking French right now and wearing a little beret, and I'd pay admission to see Bill wearing one of those.
And I do think the education and motivation of the troops helps. We're like, in Napoleon times, you might be a little nervous about telling 100 guys, hey, go run off into the woods and see what you see, because about 10 of them are going to come back.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the Civil War times, you might get some deserters, but generally the troops are motivated, they're well-educated, just like we said, better than in the past. Mm-hmm. They're not the scum of the earth. Mm-hmm. So if you send out cavalry position scouts, you send out skirmishers to go see if you can find anybody, those guys are going to actually report back to you. You recruited those guys, like the sharpshooter battalions they started forming in 1862 and 1863. They're trying to pick their smartest guys with the best initiative from all of a brigade would form. They would be with their regiments, and then when they would get to the battlefield, they'd form a Confederate sharpshooter battalion and send them out.
Well, and we'd fought, three or four wars, starting with the Revolutionary War, prior to the Civil War. So the tactics are all the same.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't learned anything.
No, not a damn thing. Yeah. You know, it's really when you get into World War One with the invention of the machine gun and the technology with the artillery that they have and the shells that can use mustard gas and all that changes everything. The tactics have to change then. You can't line up in a line.
It becomes too suicidal.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. In 1866, with the Austrian-Prussian War, the Austrians said, they'd seen that the Prussians had like these new breech loading rifles, and they're like, oh, that's going to be a problem. They're needle guns. Mm-hmm. So the Austrians said, you know, we're going to form battalion columns. We're going to form into a block and attack because it's the one thing they wouldn't expect us to do. Yeah. Facing this kind of firepower.
And you go first. Yeah.
So we really changed tactics during the Plains Indians War.
Yes, we did.
Because we were having our hind ends handed to us. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You're right.
But we'll see. At in the Vicksburg campaign, somebody does do that. They form Union units up into a tight phalanx and try to pound them into position to see if it works. We'll see if it works.
Yeah.
Well, you guys got anything left to talk about? Or we want to wrap it up here? Any closing statements, comments?
I'm afraid if we go any further, we'll
I don't think we can
dive right to it.
Closing arguments?
Save your Confederate dollars, folks. You know.
Yeah, and if you think you can get in an argument with me at a happy hour in a bar about the Civil War,
I would have paid.
You come to the wrong guy.
I would have too.
I wish I could find a bar where I could talk about the Civil War from 3 to 6 p.m.
God. I mean, somebody.
He made my night when he was texting me. I was rolling on the floor.
Oh, I was too. I thought, oh my God.
But he said, what do you know about the Civil War? I was like, oh man. Where do I start?
Yeah, bad move on his part.
All right, folks. Well, thanks for listening again. This is the Show Me History Show. We're going to be hitting it probably in 2 weeks, and we'll finish up with the Battle of Vicksburg.
Same bad time, same bad channel.
You betcha. Take care, folks.